This is the Drawing the Ideal Self podcast for June 2021. This month's podcast is going to be looking at a PCP take on offending behaviour, and it's inspired really by a TV programme that I've watched recently. The programme's called Time, and it's a TV drama series in three parts, which you can definitely get on BBC iPlayer at the moment. You may be able to get it on Netflix as well, I'm not too sure. So if you're listening in another country and you can't watch it, I'm really sorry about that, because it's very good. The programme was about a guy who is in prison, and it takes us a while to find out why he's in prison and how that's all come about. But he is there, and he doesn't really fit in with the usual prisoners, because he was a teacher before he was in prison. So the drama is about the life inside the prison, and there have been some newspaper discussions about it saying that it's very true to real prison life. So they've done a very good job, and frankly, it's at moments quite terrifying. Not necessarily because people get killed, but just the threat all the time and the loss of control and choice is quite scary, actually. It's enough to deter me. Not that I was thinking of going to prison, but definitely it would be exceedingly stressful. So in the programme, what you see is this guy's relationships with other people in the prison and how they pan out. And also you find out about why he's there and what he wants to do about that and how he feels about the crime that he's committed. The other characters are very interesting because some of them wield enormous power over other people through threats of physical violence and actual physical violence. And some people try and stand up to them and other people give in straight away because they're very frightening. And the thing I thought was very interesting is how they portrayed the outbursts of violence, which are predictable, really, because they happen in response to things that really threaten either an individual or a group of individuals. And some of that can be ordinary things, like not doing something that they want you to do, or even something like being too close to them. When we were younger, my husband and I both worked in a special school, and one of the kids that we worked with eventually went into prison. Really, it suited him because what he needed was a very predictable and rigid environment, because he'd come from a chaotic family and he found ordinary life actually more difficult. When he came out of prison, we hadn't realised this, and we said to him, you know, was it dreadful? And he said, no, it was fine. I quite liked it. And it made sense of some of the things that we'd seen in the special school, where he would fly completely off the handle over something. And I think what happened in prison, the structures were there to stop him doing things. But he told us some quite horrible tales about what life was like in there. And one of the things was that he eventually managed to get a job in the kitchen, because he was pretty well behaved, as you know, in that setting. He was fine. And he got a job in the kitchen, and there was a guy who had murdered both of his elderly parents who would come up to get his dinner. And all of the kitchen staff had to spit in this guy's dinner and then give it to him. And that happened every day. You know, to me, that would have been enough to set me flying off the rails, probably. But to him, having had such a chaotic life, it was just a rule that was followed. And he wasn't really distressed by either by doing it or by seeing that happen. He thought it was the sort of justice of the place, because this guy had killed two old people, which was much worse than anything they were doing to him, by all accounts. And I think one of the things that PCP does do is allow you to see the perspective of another person without having to agree with them. So for us, you know, there were many things about him that we didn't agree with. And he himself committed crimes. So he was in prison because he'd stabbed his brother the second time, not the first time he stabbed his brother. The first time he stabbed his brother, for some reason, he turned up on our doorstep and we took him to the police and the social care were involved and the police were involved. And he got a caution because it wasn't a serious stabbing. It was more that he couldn't go home that was the issue. So there'd been a fight between the two brothers and nobody was seriously hurt. But he had cut him with a knife, but not badly. The second time he stabbed his brother, he went to prison. You wouldn't really think he was the kind of person who might behave so outrageously, because the rest of the time he was very well behaved. And he was in my class at the school. I was a teacher then. And his behaviour in my class was extremely good. And I also worked with him on the residential side before that, when I was a residential social worker. And he was in the flat that I was in charge of with about eight boys. And his behaviour in the flat when I was on duty was always really good. He wasn't any problem. Occasionally, something would happen with another kid and he would fly off the handle. But the most serious incidents, I didn't really see happen. And I'm not quite sure what that was about. He could be so well behaved, actually, that once in a year in my class, he swore and he said bloody. And he was mortified. He was so sorry that he'd done this. Now, this was a boy who could use every swear word ever invented and could threaten people and go bananas with them over nothing, it seemed. But in that class, he was very controlled. And I've been doing a bit of reading around this before the podcast. And one of the things that I read that you might find interesting to read, there are a couple of books. One is Personal Construct Perspectives on Forensic Psychology. And that's by James Hawley. I'll put the details in the show notes. So there's a paper in that book by David Winter called A Credulous Approach to Violence and Homicide. And even the title's fairly challenging. And that paper is about understanding why people commit these terrible acts and what it is about their construing that makes it have meaning and make sense to them to do something so dreadful to somebody else. One of the things he talked about was slot rattling. And slot rattling is when you move from one end of a construct to the other. So a construct has always got two ends or poles. So happy and the other pole is sad. So in this case, it might be kind. And then at the other pole, it might be sly, or it could be safe or aggressor. So often they're written with either a hyphen between them, the two poles, or with a line between them, or with a versus, VS dot. So you might have happy versus sad. So slot rattling is when somebody moves from one end of the pole to another. And I think this is what this boy was doing, really. So his behaviour around the school and in the residential side was often extremely unpredictable. So he would fly off the handle. Once he did that, I remember this incident. He was staying in a caravan at the end of the school as a sort of preparation for independent living when he was 16. So the boys left the school at 16 or 17. Before they left, they had a couple of weeks in the caravan on their own. And the idea was to get them to do their washing, to cook for themselves and do some things like that. And it would happen in their final year. And he was staying in the caravan. And then his friend went to visit him and made a mess of some things. So his solution to that was to scream and shout at his friend and throw everything out of the caravan. All he needed to do was tidy up. However, instead of tidying up, he made it a whole lot worse, got lots of people involved with him, was seen as, you know, going crazy and totally overreacting to a situation, which was true. But how did that make sense to him? So he was extremely controlled, or he was extremely uncontrolled. And he moved between those two poles of the construct, depending on who he was with, depending on the situation. There were times in my class when I could see that he was getting cross with other kids, but he managed to hold it together. Very different from how he was in some other situations where he would lose it. Once he smashed a fish tank, one of those big aquarium type fish tanks, by throwing something into it. I think he threw a table into it so hard that the whole thing smashed, all the fish were on the floor. It was a disaster, and I came walking in to see that this had happened. Before he smashed the fish tank, when I'd seen him, before he'd gone into the flat, he had been okay. So he flipped all of a sudden over something that happened. And that's what slot rattling is like at times. So what David Winter talks about was slot rattling being one of the explanations. Maybe that's what happened with the guy who murdered his parents. Because in lots of ways, I knew the case because it was in all the newspapers. The report said he was a very good son. He was looking after his parents. He was living with them. He was supporting them to go to things. But then he killed them. So what was going on there that made that make sense? So that's quite an interesting idea, and it's worth thinking about if you're working with, particularly with young people, where they behave in ways which are unpredictable, or they may be perfectly behaved and then suddenly flip, like that boy I was talking about, or the other way round. They're usually awful, and then they flip into being fantastic. And we see that quite a lot when we're trying to help young people change, that they'll have a day where they're perfectly behaved and everything seems to be going okay. And what people complain about then is they knew what to do. They know how to be good. They can be good. Really, being good is not as simple as that. It's not, you know, we don't misbehave because we don't know how to behave. We misbehave for other reasons. And what Kelly said is people do things that are meaningful to them. So if we're going to help people who are doing bad things to each other, we need to find out how it makes sense to them to behave in that kind of way towards another person. And there are lots of reasons. One is having very tight construing so that your construing system is more easily threatened, in which case, if you're feeling threatened and that's your experience of what's going on, you might fly off the handle very quickly. Because your whole construing system collapses. So that could be the case perhaps with somebody who is the known controller in the prison or leader, and somebody comes in to threaten their position. So they're told to do something, like in the TV programme Time, the guy basically had to give his dinner up to somebody on a regular basis. He would just come and take stuff off his plate. He had a choice there of either I stop them doing it and get beaten up, or I don't stop them doing it, and it happens. If he had tried to defend himself, this person who saw himself as a leader might have gone crazy and really beaten him up for something as small as saying, no, you can't have my bread roll. Another thing David Winter draws attention to is guilt in the Kellyan sense. So that's seeing yourself in a particular role and construing yourself as, for instance, a gang leader or a bully or a bullied person or an officer. You know, that's a core role for people. So those core roles, generally speaking, we fall into them and we find roles that we feel comfortable with. And we elaborate our construing within those roles. So, you know, over the years, I've become more and more of a psychologist, not less and less. And that psychologist identity that I have has become more and more core to me. So whatever your jobs are, you will probably be experiencing a similar kind of thing. If you construe yourself as somebody who is an aggressor to others and always on the defence and won't take any nonsense from people, then actually it might be quite difficult to change that behaviour. He gives an example of women who had been abused, finding it very difficult to play the role, if you like, of being an abused person because they preferred the role of being an aggressor. Because it, you know, part of their core role was to attack other people, to hurt them, to make sure they always defended themselves. What they didn't like to think about was the experience of themselves in a different role from that, because it was very uncomfortable for them. And guilt, in a Kellyan sense, is being dislodged from a core role. So for them, he talks about the difficulty of them having therapy, because in having therapy, their role as somebody who was abused as a child themselves would come to the fore. And engaging in therapy would mean that they would be considering that and thinking about how it's affected them. And that made them feel uncomfortable. So maybe they didn't want to engage in that kind of thing, and they preferred to have the role as somebody who was difficult and someone you had to watch out for, because they would get you in some way. Another interesting one was talking in the same paper about violence as being shame avoidance. So Mildred McCoy, 1977, had a definition of shame which extended Kelly's definitions of emotions. So shame, she defined as awareness of dislodgement of the self from another's construing of your role. So David Winter says this: therefore, while violence in the service of guilt reduction may be seen as involving behaving in a way which conforms with one's own expectations of oneself, violence in the service of shame reduction involves behaving in a way which conforms with the expectations of another person. In many instances, these two sets of expectations will be very similar. And he particularly highlights episodes of violence before an audience. So he talks about those being something which may be to avoid shame. So if you are a person in a gang and you're in front of your gang and you've got to either not fight or fight, it'd be very difficult to avoid it because the gang wouldn't accept you potentially. So your reputation would be very important. And that's what shame's about, you know, sort of being dislodged from the way other people see you and not wanting that experience. David Winter says, some incidents of violence towards the police may also occur because an individual who's challenged by a police officer in front of his peers may feel that his reputation is being tested. It may be that such a challenge, particularly if insensitively made, confirms and reinforces the individual's role as a defender of principle and a champion of his kind. He talks about some episodes of violence that happen in a gang situation in front of the police may be to do with shame. So, you know, showing your gang that you can take the police on, you're not afraid, you're willing to fight them for the sake of the gang. Realistically, the same would apply to the police, that what they're doing in a gang situation like that, if there's a confrontation with a group, of what will happen if they don't join in whatever it is that's going on and going wrong. And we know there have been some terrible incidents over recent years where people have been extremely, they're afraid, bullied, hurt and killed by police officers in front of their peers. Thinking about those things, you know, what you'd be potentially construing them as in terms of PCP is episodes of shame. So that awareness of dislodgement of the self from another's construing of their role. And what that tells you is that if you're going to help people who are involved in those kind of gang-related incidents, you're going to have to find them an alternative audience that has credibility as far as they're concerned. So that might be finding them an alternative way to gain peer approval. So instead of having fights with people, they might be working in a music studio making fantastic raps, for instance. You know, that's often one of the things that's tried. They might be involved in car racing. So they're getting the thrill of car racing. They're getting the approval of the other drivers or the maintenance people for the car. But they're not getting any violent acts involved with that. So they will get their sense of self will be much more comfortable in that situation. If something goes wrong, then you're in trouble. You know, so if they've got a very fragile sense of self in those roles, they might dip out if it doesn't go well and easily, because they're stronger one will be the one that was formed earlier. So their gang-related stuff will be there. And you can see that when people go into prison, they might behave very well in prison. Everything's going okay. Looks like they're going to come out reformed. They go back, they mix with the same people, and they end up back in the same situations. And what gangs can offer is a sense of community, which for some of these people, they don't have in any other way. They may have had, you know, not very rewarding family lives, or they may have lacked status in other ways, and being in the gang provides some sense of self that isn't provided in other ways. Another one that's from the David Winter paper that's interesting is hostile violence. And what Kelly talked about with his definition of hostility is it's an effort to find evidence that your predictions are right by really faking the evidence. And at some level, you're aware of this. So the technical definition is the continued effort to extort validational evidence in favour of a type of social prediction which has already proved itself a failure. That might be the case for something like domestic violence. Winter has lots of different things that you would maybe find interesting to read, including aggressive violence, violence as an escape from chaos, violence as a way of life, violence as a shared construction. I'm not going to go through them all, but I think it would be worth you maybe having a look at those, particularly if you're working with people who are offenders or if you're working with young people who might be labelled as such, or maybe get involved in gang violence. One of the things is, you know, not being able to construe people very easily. Deficiencies in the ability to take another's perspective may be one reason for finding one's interpersonal world chaotic and unpredictable, and may, as we have seen, lead to violence directed at the removal of a person whose construing cannot be predicted. So how can PCP be useful? Well, one would be in the assessment of an individual so that you can understand what it is they're doing, why they're doing it, how they construe, for instance, their crime, what it is that, what sense they're making of themselves and where the violent acts fit in to their sense of self. The other thing is to think about what you may do to help them and to stop it happening in future. And what Winter says is that you would select therapeutic techniques on the basis of a diagnostic assessment in a PCP sense. And what you would use in terms of the assessment may be different, and what you might do in terms of interventions will be different. So he says the techniques will differ from case to case, and in some cases will be diametrically opposed. For example, while techniques aimed at tightening of construing may be employed with the offender whose violence is viewed as an attempted escape from chaos, such an approach is likely to be the last thing that is needed by the offender whose violence is an outcome of construing which is already very tight. So Winter talks about some of the techniques that might be used, such as the ABC being very useful and repertory grids. I don't use repertory grids myself, mainly because I don't like having to wait to see the results. I prefer something like a PEG. But repertory grids can be very useful when you're trying to look at things in detail. And he talks a bit about that. So he concludes that what you need is a range of techniques, and you will, as with all kinds of PCP therapy, fit them together with the person that you're working with in order to help them. So if they've got very tight construing, you'd want to be loosening. If their construing is very loose, you might want to be tightening. You might want to go through some cycles of experimentation. So following the CPC cycle, which perhaps we'll have a separate podcast on, and that's being going through really a decision-making cycle, but helping people to find points at which they find it difficult. And it may be that they are very impulsive and they often act before they've thought enough about it and explored something enough about it. So helping them to do that exploration might be very useful. But what you would do is find a way that suits every individual. And working with someone who's a criminal is exactly the same as working with everybody else, at least in terms of process. In the other book, which is Making Sense with Offenders, Personal Constructs, Therapy and Change by Julia Houston, there's a chapter which is about therapy with offenders and the PCP approach to therapy. So what she talks about is that the therapist needs to have a very credulous approach, which is to take at face value the person's experience of the world and the sense that they make of it. You know, in a PCP approach, you don't argue with that. If people say the world to them is like this, then that's how it is. You can work with that, even if what they tell you in some ways doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense at first. That's where you'd start from. So the other thing is, it's very important for the therapist to be able to understand the construing of another person. So being able to put themselves in the position of therapist and be able to understand the client's position at the same time. So not becoming too sympathetic, but being able to understand enough of the client's construing to be able to predict what might happen, or either what they may do or the way they may interpret things. So understanding them doesn't mean that you have to agree with them. She also says that what you need is a healthy and professional construct system, which is to be able to have a professional way of making sense of the client's constructions and generating hypotheses and formulations, and at the same time be able to hold your own construing, your personal construing, of people, of experiences, and all your kind of views on things. You need to hold those in abeyance while you lean on your professional system and keep yourself in an appropriate way with the client. It would be very difficult for somebody who doesn't do this to work with people who've committed crimes that, you know, really resonate with them. Crimes committed with children, you know, often would be very difficult for people to hear, and they may not want to mix with people like that ever. But if they're a therapist working in a prison, they're going to have to. So they've got to have a very professional way of managing that construing. She also argues that the therapist should allow themselves, even so, to be creative and intuitive in order to recognise new constructs that emerge in therapy. So just as in therapy with other people, working with offenders, you'd be trying to find ways and to help people generate new constructs and use them well. She also says that you shouldn't be too fixed in your view about what is best for the client. So although you can't condone any antisocial behaviours that may be socially deviant but are not harmful or illegal, you know, you may have a view of as yourself as a person, but as a therapist working, it may be that you need to accept that and also not be thinking that it's not okay for those people to do those kind of things. So if something doesn't hurt somebody else, it's a value judgment about whether it's okay or not to do it. And she says that the therapist shouldn't be too fixed about what's best for their client. And then finally, she says that the therapist should be able to provide an atmosphere of acceptance, reassurance and support in which the client is the expert concerning the nature and content of their own personal construct system, and the therapist has professional expertise in their knowledge of psychotherapeutic strategies. It's a very clear role for the therapist, and also in support of the client. So in working with offenders, you shouldn't be doing it if you're not able to do that. So if what you find is it's very difficult to contain your own anger or upset or distress when you're talking to somebody who's committed crimes against people, because that's the most likely people who'll be in prison, then it's not a very safe place for you to be, because your own construing may slip out. And if you haven't got that all kind of sorted out in your own head about how you're going to manage those situations, and you haven't been able to use supervision and professional networks so that you learn how to manage feelings in that situation, then it's not going to be the right kind of job for you. Nor me. I don't know that I could do that. Another point Julia Houston makes is about who is consenting to therapy. And she says the main dilemma for the therapist in using the personal construct approach to therapy with offenders is that the client himself may not be the person who is requesting help. Clearly, if the individual does not attend appointments, refuses to discuss their behaviour with the therapist, or maintains consistently that they do not want to change, then there is little that any therapist can do to intervene, even if the client's behaviour is potentially dangerous. However, with most offender clients, their resistance to change is not quite so overt. In most cases, the potential harm to others caused by the client's behaviour would outweigh the personal construct clinician's reluctance to point out the benefits of change. If the client at least attends the therapeutic sessions and talks about their behaviour, it is possible to assess the factors which may underlie ambivalence and resistance to change, identify potential areas of conflict in construing, demonstrate understanding of the client's perspective, and ensure that they are fully aware of the possibilities for change. So Julia Houston ends her chapter talking about the fact that you can't make people change, that change will be possible for people only if they're able to recognise the ways that they've been construing things before and develop new constructions. So their construing system has to change in order for them to change through personal construct psychotherapy. So if they are seeking that kind of help to change, then a PCP approach is likely to be very helpful. Okay, well, I think that's probably enough. If you're interested, it may have whet your appetite. If you're really not interested in this kind of thing, we've got some different things coming up in the podcast. So the next PCP podcast will be about using a PCP approach with people who've had some kind of a brain injury. So that could be through an accident or a stroke. Kathy Sparks is going to talk about her work that she does with people who've had those experiences and what some of the challenges are, both for the people that she works with and also for the therapists. So that's coming up in July. Hopefully, I won't have put you off. And even if I have, you'll come back and listen to Kathy, because it's going to be a very interesting episode. Okay, time to go, I think. So hopefully you'll have a lovely July, and I'll see you again at the end of July. Okay, thanks very much for listening. Bye.